like to talk in this fourth session on an aspect of the Bible that's often kind of overlooked. People sometimes have referred to it as the Cinderella of the Bible, that is the wisdom tradition and how it has found its way into a number of the Psalms. Wisdom was greatly appreciated in the ancient Near Eastern world. And if you go back to the time of the pyramids, you'll find in Egypt in 3000 BC and from then on, there were great wisdom teachers and they wrote books of wisdom about life and living, very practical instruction for living, very often written specifically with the king's son in mind for when he'd take over or for the son of a high official or some other person like that, instruction about living. Some of the books then were written in a more general way for everybody. And the basic idea of wisdom in the ancient Near Eastern world was that nobody is born wise. And no person's individual life is long enough or varied enough to gain all the experience we need, you know, in order to live wisely, so that we have to learn it. And therefore, what happened was that they collected and distilled the wisdom of the generations and the communal wisdom handed on in story or in proverb or aphorism or whatever. These were put together in collections and the wisdom teachers became very central to the handing on of the wisdom of the generations, built up through practical experience. Most of the wisdom dealt with ordinary, everyday living. You might think of Dale Carnegie's book, you know, How to Win Friends and Influence People. There was a lot of that in it, how to be a good administrator, a good teacher, a good parent, a good husband, a good wife. And, you know, all that very practical wisdom about life. Sometimes, too, religious concerns came into it and ethical concerns. And we're told to say that Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of Egypt. And the tradition came into the people of Israel, that idea of wisdom. And you find with Solomon, particularly David, I suppose, certainly sent, but particularly with Solomon, the whole tradition of wisdom takes off. We get books like the books of Proverbs and so on, in which there's a great deal of very practical wisdom about life and living. The teacher of wisdom was very highly prized. And as they looked to the idea of wisdom, they began to associate wisdom with their own religious tradition. The traditions of Israel, the tradition of the law, the tradition of the prophets and so on that they had learned. They see in these, you know, a wisdom of God, that God's wisdom is coming through in a special way. God is also seen as the great creator, the great creator whose wisdom it was made creation and supports creation, and how that wisdom of God in creation is the same wisdom that has inspired the prophets, inspired the law, inspired the great teachers and so on. So you're going to find a marriage of what we might call the wisdom traditions, which were broader than Israel, and the very specific ethical monotheism of Israel. And the marriage of these gives us some of the great books of the Old Testament. The wisdom, of course, develops, and you get questions about life and the meaning of life, and the meaning of suffering, the meaning of justice, the whole idea, is there an afterlife with a judgment in which we're answerable for living our lives? All these questions find their way into the wisdom literature. And also you find that experience of life sometimes challenges the traditional understanding. For example, if you look at the book of Job, basically, the book of Job is a challenge to the traditional idea, if you live well, you will be prosperous. God will be on your side, and you'll be prosperous and live long in the land. The book of Job is a very definite challenge to that very simple idea. It says that Job was very good. Job lived a very good and upright life. And look at all the things that happened to Job. And Job has to end up more or less saying, well, God is God. We take good things from God. We take other things as well. That's evil things as well. So you get all that kind of tradition coming into Israel. And a lot of it is reflected in the Psalms. You also get kind of the idea of the good life. Well, it leads to a certain amount of happiness and contentment and prosperity before God. The wicked life, the evil life, will certainly end up in disaster. And I just look in there at one reading from chapter 3 of the Book of Wisdom. We read half it at funerals, usually. We'd probably have a walk out if we read the whole lot. Just read a few. It is an example, you know, of the fate of the good and of the just and the unjust, the virtuous and the evil ones. The souls of the virtuous are in the hands of God. No torment shall ever touch them. In the eyes of the unwise, they did appear to die. Their going looked like a disaster. They're leaving us like annihilation, but they are at peace. If they experience punishment as men see it, their hope was rich with immortality. Slight was their affliction, great will their blessing be, etc. and so on. But the godless will be duly punished for their reasoning. For neglecting the virtuous man and deserting the Lord. Yes, wretched are they who scorn wisdom and discipline. Their hope is void, their toil unavailing, their achievements unprofitable, their wives reckless, their children depraved, and their descendants accursed. Now, just look, you have to take it into context. Just look at the contrast of the fate of the wise, the fate of the virtuous, and the fate of the godless. That kind of the two ways, where do they go? And that you couldn't read both sides of that at a funeral. You'd have a walk out. We normally read the first part. Now, if you look at Psalm 1, Psalm 1 is exactly the same thing. Happy indeed is the one who follows not the counsel of the wicked, nor lingers in the way of sinners, nor sits in the company of scorners, but whose delight is the law of the Lord, and who ponders his law day and night. He's like a tree that is planted beside the flowing waters, that yields its fruit in due season, and whose leaves shall never fade, and all that he does shall prosper. Not so the wicked, not so. For they, like winnowed chaff, shall be driven away by the wind. When the wicked are judged, they shall not stand, nor find room among those who are just. For the Lord guards the way of the just, but the way of the wicked leads to doom. Notice the two ways. It's very much in that tradition. Now, if you look at Psalm 13 or 14 in the higher numbering, the fool has said in his heart, there is no God above. Their deeds are corrupt, depraved, not a good man is left. From heaven the Lord looks down on the children of men to see if any are wise, if any seek God. All have left the right path, depraved every one. There's not a good person left, not even one. Will the evildoers not understand? They eat up my people as though they ate bread. They never pray to the Lord. See how they tremble with fear, without cause for fear. For God is with the just. You may mock the poor man's hope, but his refuge is the Lord. Oh, that Israel's salvation might come from Zion. When the Lord delivers his people from bondage, then Jacob will be glad and Israel rejoice. Notice again the contrast of the wise person and the fool. If you look at 18, and here you have possibly a putting together of a number of different psalms from different traditions. And even the meter of the psalms, different sections is different. And it starts off looking at the grandeur of creation. And you're struck by God as the great craftsman of creation. And the wisdom that went into the making of creation. That wisdom is now enshrined in the law, and we're given all the great life-giving power of the law. We'll just look at it. The first part, the heavens proclaim the glory of God, and the firmament shows forth the work of his hands. Day unto day takes up the story, and night unto night makes known the message. No speech, no word, no voice is heard, yet their span goes forth to all the earth, their words to the utmost bounds of the world. There he has placed a tent for the sun. It comes forth like a bridegroom coming from his tent, rejoices like a champion to run its course. At the end of the sky is the rising of the sun. To the furthest end of the sky is its course. There is nothing concealed from its burning heat. Now you have the whole idea of the great wisdom in creation, God the Creator. But God the Creator has given us a wisdom that has taken up our place in Israel, in the law. The law of the Lord is perfect. It revives the soul. The rule of the Lord is to be trusted. It gives wisdom to the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right. They gladden the heart. The command of the Lord is clear. It gives light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is holy, abiding forever. The decrees of the Lord are truth, and all of them just. They are more to be desired than gold, than the purest of gold, and sweeter are they than honey from the comb. So in them your servant finds instruction. Great reward is in their keeping. But who can detect all his errors? From hidden faults acquit me. From presumption restrain your servant. Let it not rule me. Then shall I be blameless, clean from grave sin. May the spoken words of my mouth, the thoughts of my heart, win favour in your sight, O Lord, my rescuer and my God. Notice the law of the Lord, it gives life to the soul, it gives wisdom to the simple, it gladdens the heart, gives light to the eyes, abides forever, it gives truth. They are more to be desired than gold, they're sweeter than honey, and they give instruction, and there's great reward in keeping them. Notice, you know, the law and the wisdom in the law, if we follow it, it's life-giving power, how it fills up our lives and so on with power. And then, but who can detect all his errors? From hidden faults acquit me. That, you know, that's like the story of Job when the friends are telling him he must have done something wrong that he's not aware of. And there's a prayer there, insofar as there's something I'm unaware of, you know, acquit me from that. And from presumption restrain your servant, let it not rule me. The whole idea of presumption and pride come across in the Psalms, you know, as very obnoxious and very destructive. You know, the one who has his face in the clouds, his head in the heavens and dictates to the earth. That kind of idea. The opposite to that is the humble, the person who has his or her feet on the ground and knows who he or she is and where they stand before God. And they are the pure, they are the meek that we have in the Beatitude. Blessed are the meek, they shall inherit the earth. So that's just a lovely psalm there, Psalm 18. And if you look at Psalm 33, 34. I will bless the Lord at all times, his praise always on my lips. In the Lord my soul shall make its boast, the humble shall hear and be glad. Glorify the Lord with me, together let us praise his name. I sought the Lord and he answered me. I sought the Lord, he answered me, and from all my terrors he set me free. Look towards him and be radiant, let your faces not be abashed. The poor man called, the Lord heard him and rescued him from all his distress. Now, further down it says, come children and hear me, that I may teach you the fear of the Lord. Who is he who longs for life and many days to enjoy his prosperity? Then keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. Turn aside from evil and do good. Seek and strive after peace. Now notice the fear of the Lord, or the awe before God, is the beginning of wisdom. And this comes out here that the fear of God. Now, fear in a positive sense of awe before the majesty of God. That is the beginning of wisdom. When one sets out from there, then one walks in the path of the Lord. Who is he who longs for life and many days to enjoy his prosperity? Keep your tongue from evil and your lips from speaking deceit. In the wisdom tradition, in ancient Egypt, in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, speech comes up all the time, knowing when to speak and when to be silent, knowing when to control the tongue. The Egyptian literature, you find a lovely image that the belly is like a storehouse, which has all kinds of good and evil in it. And the mouth is like the door. Keep the door firmly locked. You know, that kind of imagery. And remember the letter of James, he talks about the tongue like the rudder of the boat, you know, and it can set a whole forest aflame. That's very much in the tradition of wisdom. You find there, in the psalm we just had, the thoughts of my heart and the words of my mouth and so on, may they be pleasing in your sight, O Lord. You have that emphasis on speech. Then there's a lovely image also, I think it is in one of the Egyptian books of wisdom, which speaks about wisdom. Wisdom will be a mooring stake for your tongue when there's a whirlwind of words. Beat that for an image. Now, evil brings death to the wicked, those who hate the good are doomed. The Lord ransoms the souls of his servants. Those who hide in him shall not be condemned. Notice again, you have the two ways which we refer to. Psalm 48:49. Again, in this tradition. Hear this, all you peoples. Give heed, all who dwell in the world. Men low and high, rich and poor alike. My lips will speak words of wisdom. My heart is full of insight. I will turn my mind to a parable. With the harp, I will solve my problem. Notice now, kind of like the poet almost is going to make a song about it. Why should I fear in evil days the malice of the foes who surround me? Men who trust in their wealth and boast of the vastness of their riches. For no man can buy his own ransom or pay a price to God for his life. The ransom of his soul is beyond him. He cannot buy life without end, nor avoid coming to the grave. He knows that wise people and foolish must both perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling place from age to age, though their names spread wide through the land. In his riches, man lacks wisdom. He's like the beasts that are destroyed. This is the lot of the self-confident who have others at their beck and call. Like sheep, they are driven to the grave, where death shall be their shepherd, and the just shall become their rulers. With the morning, their outward show vanishes, and the grave becomes their home. But God will ransom me from death and take my soul to himself. Then, do not fear when someone grows rich and the glory of his house increases. He takes nothing with him when he goes below. He takes nothing when he dies, and his glory does not follow him below. Though he flattered himself while he lived, men will praise us for doing well for ourselves. Yet he will go to join his fathers, who'll never see the light anymore. Oh, in his riches man lacks wisdom. He's like the beasts that are destroyed. So the psalmist consoles himself when he sees people around him and they're getting richer and richer and they don't care a bit about uprightness and the poor and all the rest. And he's there and he says, yeah, look what's in store. In his riches, man lacks wisdom, like the beasts that are destroyed. Look at Psalm 52. The fool has said in his heart. Notice how we've meeting the fool a good bit. But yeah, this is very much in the wisdom tradition. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God above. Their deeds are corrupt, depraved, that a good man is left. But God looks down from heaven on the children of men to see if any are wise, if any seek God. All have left the right path, depraved every one. There's not a good man left, not even one. Will the evildoers not understand? They eat up my people as though they were eating bread. They never pray to God. See how they tremble with fear, without cause for fear, for God scatters the bones of the wicked. They are shamed, rejected by God. Oh, that Israel's salvation might come from Zion. When God delivers his people from bondage, then Jacob will be glad and Israel rejoice. And Psalm 72, again in that vein. How good God is to Israel, to those who are pure of heart. Yet my feet came close to stumbling, my steps had almost slipped, for I was filled with envy of the proud when I saw how the wicked prosper. For them there are no pains, their bodies are sound and slick, they have no share in people's sorrows, they are not stricken like others. So they wear their pride like a necklace. They clothe themselves with violence. Their hearts overflow with malice. Their minds seethe with plans. They scoff. They speak with malice. From on high they plan oppression. They have set their mouths in the heavens and their tongues dictate to the earth. So the people turn to follow them and drink in all their words. They say, how can God know? Does the Most High take notice? Look at them. Such are the wicked, and untroubled they grow in wealth. How useless to keep my heart pure and wash my hands in innocence, when I was stricken all day long, suffered punishment day after day. And then I said, if I should speak like that, I'd betray the race of your sons. I strove to fathom this problem, too hard for a mind to understand, until I pierced the mysteries of God and understood what becomes of the wicked. How slippery are the paths on which you set them. You make them slide to destruction. How suddenly they come to their ruin, wiped out, destroyed by terrors. Like a dream one wakes from, O Lord. When you wake, you dismiss them as phantoms. And so when my heart grew embittered, and when I was cut to the quick, I was stupid and did not understand, no better than a beast in your sight. And I was always in your presence. You were holding me by the right hand. You will guide me by your counsel, and you will lead me to glory. That's just a lovely reflection, you know, on the one looking at the foolish and how they seem to be doing so well and so on. But in the long run, the paths they walk on are slippery, and the just person mightn't appear to be very kind of prosperous in the eyes of the world, but he is very snugly, or she very snugly, ensconced in the presence of God and very close to God. There are just some thoughts on the wisdom tradition in the Old Testament. Just to say just a word or two about some aspects of the poetry, in the, just the final kind of word of the actual poetry in the Psalms. As you know, in translation, you always lose something. That translation, the Italians have a saying, traduttore traditore, the translator is a traitor. And you lose the rhythm very often of the poem. Very often, a poem begins, for example, with a few lines that reflect each other. There are different kinds of parallelisms. For example, you get the repetition of words at the beginning of a sentence. You might notice this. The Lord is with me, I fear not. What can anyone do against me? The Lord is with me to help me. I shall look down on my foes. Or you can get, for example, the repetition of words at the end of a sentence. All the nations encompass me. In the Lord's name I crush them. They compass me on every side. In the Lord's name I crush them. they're technically known as anaphora and epiphora, you know, where the psalm begins with kind of a line or a little thought, and it repeats it either, you know, in the opening or the closing of the lines. Again, you get parallelism, synonymous meaning in the sentiment, he who is enthroned in the heavens laughs. Now say it another way, the Lord derides them. Or you can have, happy the one who follows not the counsel of the wicked, nor walks in the way of sinners, nor sits in the company of scorners. A building up of images. Or you can have the antithetic ones, like balancing opposite, he has put down the mighty from the thrones, he has raised up the lowly. You know, to watch little things like that, very often they're lost in translation. I'll just point those out to you. For the actual reading of a psalm, very often is important how we read it. And that, you know. So they're basically the few points I want to make about the psalms. Of course, you have the messianic psalms, the hope for the future, reflecting, you know, the idea that the Lord's anointed in a special way will come. And Jesus picks up on one of these, you know, when he says, who did the people say that the Son of Man is? Whose son is he? And they say, David's. And he says, but why then did David say, the Lord said to my Lord, sit on my right, I'll make your enemies a footstool. There's an example now of a psalm being interpreted in the New Testament on the lips of Jesus, being interpreted as applying to himself as a messianic psalm. David saying, the Lord said to my Lord, sit on my right hand. And you get that kind of looking to the future. And the early Christians, of course, when they were trying to come to terms with all that had happened in the life, death and resurrection of Jesus, they looked to the Old Testament generally, including the Psalms, to get a language and a series of images and categories in which to give expression to their faith in Jesus Christ. There were many titles in the Old Testament. We saw a number of them there talking about the Psalms, Lord and Christ, the Anointed One, which is Christ, the Messiah, the Anointed One, the Shepherd, and so on. You see all those titles. They're all used of Jesus, but no one title is sufficient to make a full expression of whom they believe Jesus to be. So they use the various titles, and often they use them in association with each other, sparking off each other in order to give a very rich understanding of Jesus. You find also in the New Testament that one of the great problems they have is speaking about the death of Jesus. That the Jews expected a Messiah, the word in Hebrew means the Anointed One, to be anointed by God, set aside and empowered by God, naturally to overcome his enemies. And here you have a Christ who seems to have been overpowered himself and destroyed. And if, you know, Jesus is the Christ now at the right hand of the Father, why did he suffer in this way? Why had he to go through this awful agony and death? The pagan converts to Christianity, they would have had a similar problem, that for them the religious person or the great philosopher was honoured at the end of his days. An honourable death was seen as a great authenticating mark on an upright person's life. And here you have Jesus having been crucified and disgraced in the eyes of the Jews, and disgraced also in the eyes of the Greco-Roman world. What can they say about that? How can you preach this kind of Christ? St. Paul put it very well when he said, to the Jews a stumbling block, to the Gentiles foolishness. He speaks about the Jews looking for signs and the Greeks looking for wisdom. And he speaks of Christ as the wisdom and the power of God. Christ, I preach Christ crucified. To the Jews a stumbling block, to the Gentiles foolishness, but to those who are called, be they Jew or Greek, a Christ who is the wisdom and the power of God. And the New Testament, examining the Old Testament and the Psalms, they point, you know, to how the Christ was to suffer, and in and through the suffering to enter into his glory. And Jesus, him that final prayer that we looked at there earlier, in that, my God, why have you forsaken me? We can see that salvation came to us, not from the throne of a king, an earthly king, not from a palace, not from a point of view of power, but through a person who identified with the suffering people, the suffering servant, the anuim, the outcast, the unjustly judged person who was cast aside by his own. And it was in and through that experience and the Divine One who identified with that human experience at the very dregs of human suffering, that in and through that we find the glory of God manifested to us. And we can read some psalm like Psalm 21, 22 and see, you know, so clearly how the person praying that psalm in the depths of suffering at the same time is opening up to the wonderful power of God in their lives.